I have spent an entire lifetime struggling with temptation. I have struggled with alcohol. I have struggled with sex, pornography at a very young age. You know, struggling with that even as a newly married guy, you know, those temptations and those thoughts. And 7 years in our marriage, you know, I struggled with infidelity and almost ended our marriage then. And then I got sober and thought that would fix everything. All the other stuff would stop as well, you know. And just eventually going down the path I was, and the more success I got with my career, the more I thought I could have what I wanted and do what I wanted to do. I created this dual life, lust, no matter who they were or where I was, you know. Could be in church. I entered into a relationship outside of my marriage with someone. I'm a bad person. You know, I kept my wife in the dark about everything. I was there, but I wasn't there. I was present, but not present. That in itself led to me starting to branch out and want to start up other things with other women. The sexting and all that started up with random people that I didn't even know. I was convinced I'm going to leave my wife. I'm going to leave my kids. But now I'm in so deep, I don't know what to do. I'm sunk. I was just a dead person. I was. I had run out of lies. And my wife figured out what was going on.
I've read that infidelity is the next to the death of a child, the worst pain. It's so painful. You're in this pit and you don't see that there's you don't feel like there's any way out. And then you'd have to tell your kids. Infidelity, we have dealt with that. Dave knows what that brings in a relationship. He knows how much pain that causes. It is so hard to believe that anybody could come home to their family and look at them and lie to them like he did. As painful as it was, as heartbreaking as it was, I still knew that I would be committed to my marriage vows. I knew I had to forgive him, and I was going to have to walk out that forgiveness.
She chose to honor God and to honor our marriage by fighting for it rather than walking away.
Dave and I were on our knees in our living room.
And she started praying for me and then prayed with me. At that moment, I had the opportunity to give my life away, finally. That was the night that I asked God to come to me right where I was and to rescue me and get me out of this pit that I was in. And I thought I had to tell him what a wreck and what a mess I was, and he already knew. And took me as I was. That's all I really wanted, for somebody to just take me the way I was.
Even though I was in the throes of all that pain and hurt and brokenness, once we opened our eyes, I knew something had changed in Dave. He saw the beauty of the Christ for the first time.
To do somebody completely one way and then turn around and do you completely the opposite, I guess that's what God does with us, you know? I guess that's what grace is. We get what we don't deserve. My name is Dave Robbins, and I am second.
I recognize that for those of you in the room that hear this story, that there are different reactions that come from some of us. And there's some of you in the room that your reaction is when you see somebody willing to offer grace and willing to do this, that your reaction is, I don't believe this. I don't believe that it's true. That once a cheater, always a cheater. I've heard that phrase many times. That when somebody decides to do what they do, then they obviously have stepped off, and therefore they need to suffer the consequences of the mistake that they made. And some of us in the room today, as we're trying to examine the claims of Christ, and as we try to look at our lives and the idea of, is it's a better story with Jesus, is that even you, even though you may have been coming to church your entire life, or you're here today for the very first time, there's some of you in the room that watch a story like that, and there's something inside of you that says, that doesn't happen. It can't be true. And we struggle with that. But there's another group of us in the room. And the other group of us in the room may be the more difficult group in the room, and that is this, that I don't want it to be true. You've been hurt before, haven't you? I mean, somebody did this kind of thing to you. Maybe it wasn't infidelity. Maybe it was stealing. That somebody that you trusted and you love found a way to your bank account, and so they took thousands upon thousands of dollars from you, and they were close to you. And you know that there's something in you that needs to talk about this understanding of grace, and you need to have this idea of making it like it never happened before. But there's something in you that says, I know that I should be this way. I know that I should move on. I know that I should allow this opportunity to forgive and to give this to happen, but there's something in you that just says, I don't want it to be true. And the reason you don't want it to be true is because there's a side of every one of us that has a justice inside of us, a sense of truth that we say, hey, this is law. And when law tells us that this is right and this is wrong, and when somebody chooses to do wrong and it leaves us hurting and painful, and it leaves us with a trail of absolute tears behind, I want something to make it right. And so for some of us today, even as we get through and we get into this conversation, we're having a struggle because we're saying, I really don't want grace to be true. And while you may not say that out loud, it's evidenced in how you look at other individuals. It's evidenced in how you treat them. It's evidenced in how you forgive or don't forgive. It's evidenced in the things of when you say, hey, here's the line, and I draw the line here. And when somebody does this, then that's the line, and I cannot look past that line. It's evidenced in those things that you don't want it to be true. And so John would have this unique way that he would begin his gospel. And as he get this idea, John was the best friend of Jesus, and he wrote down these ideas. One of the things that was happening in his day is that there was this incredible amount of thought and process that was going on. In Jesus' day, the people who were known in that time in the world were Greek philosophers, and they would gather and they would put together all of these ideas and thoughts, and they would create this idea and understanding that deities are here and we're down down here, and we never quite get to the deities, and they never come down here. And in the course of this conversation, John would begin his gospel with some incredible ideas and words. And here's what he would say in John 1:14. He'd put these words: "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Notice how he starts. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. It's a direct reference to Jesus and the concept of what he's trying to bring, which Greek philosophy was a part of understanding, is that the Word is the embodiment of everything. That this concept of the Word that the philosophers would talk about over and over again, and they would say, look, some people have knowledge, some people have understanding, people have these things together, but there has to be somebody out there who puts all understanding and all knowledge together, and there's something that happens, and that is the Word, and that Word embodies everything. It all goes into that, and John wanted to begin his conversation. John wanted to begin his gospel by this understanding and this idea that when God came down and decided to do something that no deity had ever done in the history of mankind and dwell among his people, that that embodiment of everything decided to hang out with you and with me. And it's unique. And in this very verse, he describes this understanding, this idea that not only did he come down here, but that's not what made Jesus so unique. In this verse, he describes it. And in this verse, he says that Jesus was all grace and all truth all the time. You see the uniqueness of this? Because you see, for you and I, we love the concept of truth. We love the concept of a person who would come down and they would right the wrongs of those people who've wronged us. And we love this idea of truth. And here's the thing, is that in Jesus' day, there were people who claimed to be messiahs, and they would come and they would talk about truth, and they had a greater truth than anyone else. And so this is the level of truth, and my truth's up here, and people talked about truth. But that's not what was attractional to Jesus. You see, the thing that was attractional to Jesus is that the fact that he was all truth all the time. It was the fact that he was all grace and truth all the time. That all the time he was grace and all the time that he was truth. And the thing that became so attracted for people to be attracted to Jesus was this concept or this idea of grace. It was the ultimate attraction to Jesus. That people would come and they who thought that they had absolutely no opportunity before God would get the greatest opportunity of all, the forgiveness of their sins. And the idea behind grace is an idea that even 2,000 years later, as you and I gather in a church building, we still cannot comprehend the fullness of it. So what is grace? What is it? I mean, you have your ideas. Some of you were raised in thought patterns or theology that says, oh, we're all about grace, and you've learned nice little catchy sayings about grace and what it looks like and what it is, but there's something still in you that it hasn't permeated deep enough into your heart that you still prefer truth over grace time and time again. You see, the kind of grace that Jesus brought was the kind of grace that was undeserved. The people that Jesus would talk about, and the story that we're going to go today, is a story of a person who that quite honestly had felt like, you know what, I have screwed things up so bad, I just don't deserve it. And so I'm just going to go ahead and accept the judgment of other people. And some of you are there. You know you've made mistakes, and you know those mistakes are huge, and you're at a place in your life where you just say, you know what, I just don't deserve it. I mean, I know there are people in here that do. I mean, they've done some wrong things, but their wrong things are so shallow, so little, that they deserve grace, but I don't. I don't deserve these kind of things. It's unearned. You realize that you can't do enough good things in your life to pay back this grace. It's unmerited favor. You come in and you stand before people and you realize that the very people you stand next to are the ones who you look at and say, man, I don't deserve to be in this crowd. And ultimately, it's as if it never happened. See, That's the struggle, isn't it? We love to talk about this idea that sin has its consequences, and it does. But you and I are more interested in exacting consequences than we are in offering grace. And so some of us today see this phrase of grace, and we watch this, and for some of you in the room, this very definition makes you very uneasy. And for others of us in this room, this very definition makes us want it. We long for it. And the reason that we long for it is because there's something in us, much like the story, where we look at it and we say, man, I don't deserve it. I can't earn it. And quite honestly, I don't need to be, I cannot even think of myself being a part of it. But to get to the place as if it never happened seems so foreign and distant to my world. And here's the best thing about grace, and one of the reasons that Jesus was so attractive is that this idea and understanding of grace doesn't exist until it's experienced. You see, I can go to someone and I can say, you know what, I'm going to offer grace to a person who's a criminal that I've never met before. And quite honestly, they would say, okay, good. Some person who's a pastor at some church in some place, in a place called Indiana, offered me this opportunity. And so that was so nice of them. But the truth is, I don't know that person. I don't have a relationship with that person. And the best part about Jesus is that he was able to come down here and he was able to hang out with us and he was able to be 100% truth and 100% grace. And what I love about that is that the very things that you experienced, the wrongs that you have been wronged, the very things that you've been hurt by, the very things that have caused you pain and have given you the reality of I can't offer grace to anyone are the very things that Christ experienced in his life. And he's able to give us this understanding, this idea, this true nature of what does grace really look like. And it is so compelling to some. And to others, it makes us so uncomfortable. And in order to experience it, the idea is this, is you have to be into some kind of relationship to see it up close, to feel it, to touch it. It's why we'd watch the video and Dave would tell his story and his wife would come along and say, hey, there's a point that I'm going to remain faithful and I'm going to choose to forgive and we are going to move forward. Why? Because there's something about grace that happens in the context of relationship that some of us in the room have experienced and it changes us forever. And some of you long for it. And some of you are afraid to give it. And so today's story is one that's fairly common, but it's a story about an individual who quite honestly thought, I am so far out of God's will, I don't deserve any kind of grace and favor, and allowing Jesus to give this opportunity brings forth a different idea. And if you have a Bible, you can turn to Luke the 19th chapter. And in Luke the 19th chapter, there's this common story that maybe some of you, if you were raised in a church, you've heard this story. But if you're new, you may not have heard this story. And it's an incident that occurred with Jesus. You see, he was entering Jericho. It was a town in his day. And he was making his way through the town. Basically, by this time in Jesus' ministry, he was a rock star. And so everywhere he would go, the press release would come out. People were looking. They were ready for him to come. And those who called themselves the church folk, the righteous folk, they were the first ones to line up. And you know why? Because there's not a better show than a righteous guy showing up and everybody else seeing the healings take place and all this stuff happening. And so they would get there early. I mean, some of you know what this is like. I mean, you saw the Rose Bowl parade and you saw these people going up and down the streets. But what you didn't see is that those folks arrived way early in the morning to be a part of that parade. Or you watch the ball drop in New York City and you may in the back of your mind just assume that as the ball was dropping that all of that 5 million or how many ever million people were downtown New York City showed up 5 minutes before you turned on the TV. But you know that's not true. You know, some of those people have stood there for hours upon hours ready to see this incredible event. And Jesus made his way through town. People know this. And so they're lined up. They're ready to see Jesus. And then it says there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was the chief tax collector in the region and had become very rich. Now, you have to understand a little bit about this guy named Zacchaeus. because the scripture tells us that he was the chief tax collector. And how the chief tax collector worked was simply like this. A person who was one of the family, a Jewish individual, would go to the Roman authorities, and the Roman authorities had to collect taxes. That's how they made this incredible road system that was a part of the ancient world that you can still see even today. And so the issue was is that the Romans would tax all of the places that they had overcome. And in order for them to collect the taxes, they knew the best way to do it was to grab somebody from the family. And so Jewish individuals, people like Zacchaeus, would go and he would ask the Roman authorities, hey, I would love to be the person that collects the taxes. You know why? Because I know those people. I grew up with those people. We played soccer together. We'd hang out together. I know their kids. I know all those things. And so what a better way to get into people's pockets than through their family? And this is the reason the Jews hated tax collectors. And the reason that they hated those who were the chief tax collectors is because this is what would happen, is that this person would be given a sum of money that they need to collect for the Romans. Let's say in today's dollars, a million US dollars. That was the sum of money that they needed to collect. And they would realize, okay, in order for me to do this, and what the Romans would say is anything you collect above that, it's yours. You can have it. And so the chief collector would go to the Roman authorities and they would agree upon a figure, and this is how it would work. They would realize that money is so much, I need some people to help me out. And so they would go and they would recruit people who would help them out to collect this much money over here. That was the idea. And then they would realize that it was such a big task and that there were so many people that were gathered around that they couldn't make it work. And so these people had to go and they had to hire additional people. And so they would go and they would hire additional people and they would collect taxes. And these guys were just known as regular tax collectors. And then these guys would go and they would hire more and more people. And here's what happens. This is the original pyramid scheme, right? And the idea is this, the money trickles up. And these guys would collect, and eventually they would be in the same village and they'd live on the same street as you. And there was some tax collector down here and he knew how much your family was worth. Why? Because he was part of the family. And the point is, these guys were sellouts. These guys worked for the enemies. And this guy up here was the worst sellout of all. And this is the reason why anytime you read in the New Testament and they talk about tax collectors, people in the crowd would boo, we hate those guys. And then they walk down the street, boo, boo. Why? Because they knew your pockets and they were reaching directly in your pockets and giving your money to the enemy. And so we find out in this very incredible story that Jesus comes to town and this individual named Zacchaeus was the main guy in the region who was collecting all of the taxes, and he had become extremely wealthy from stealing from your pocket and my pocket. And this is why people didn't like him too much. And the story unfolds in the next few verses. So he tried to get a look at Jesus. And like what would happen in moments like this where he felt like, hey, look, I just want to know who this guy is. I've heard a lot about him and I just would like to know. The problem is that all the places are already taken. The street is already packed with people. They've already gotten there. They've been waiting for all day to be able to see this guy. Why? Because they're religious. They're holy. They want to see another holy guy. And they want to be able to connect and the dots and talk about all of their righteousness. And in the course of this, he doesn't know what he's doing. So he runs ahead and he climbs a tree and he knows that Jesus is going to go that way. He kind of checks the trajectory and he gets up in this tree. And you can imagine as he's getting up in this tree, I mean, you imagine being the person who's below him. He's wearing a tunic. And so you can imagine all kinds of... Just figure it out yourself. And so here's what would happen. So Jesus walks by, he looks up at Zacchaeus and he called him by name and he says, Zacchaeus, quick, come down. And you need to know that at that moment, all of the people who are on the ground, all of the people who are waiting around would have thought to themselves, this is 100% truth, Jesus. He is going to condemn this guy for stealing from us. He is going to yell at this guy. He's going to tell this guy he's going to hell. And the reason he's going to hell is because he stole from us. And the people in this moment would have thought, yes, justice has come to Israel on this day. And any of you in the room who hope that it's not true, you would have been in that moment a part of the crowd. Because he stole from you. And he stole from your kids and your grandkids. And he continues to steal. And if anybody does not deserve the favor of God, it's this guy, because he's the biggest jerk that ever walked the planet. And then Jesus does something miraculous in the moment. He says this, "I must be a guest in your house today." This is why we struggle with grace. Because you and I have put a standard on grace in which we say, this person deserves it, but this person doesn't. This is who should get it, this is who shouldn't. And to the people in Jesus' day, they did the exact same thing. I mean, listen to the response of the crowd, because in this moment, he climbs down and he takes Jesus to his house. He's so excited and he's so joyful, but the people were displeased. They're grumbling and they're saying, he's gone to be the guest of a notorious sinner. They're saying, Jesus, where is the truth? This guy disqualified himself. This guy stole from us. This guy's been taking from us for years. And the point is this, you're asking him to go hang out with this guy. You're gonna go and have tea with him. You're gonna go and have a meal with him. You're gonna go be a part of this. And you and I, even in modern day America, still struggle at times. And the struggle we have is because we're saying, hey, look, I've always been a good person. I've always been a decent person. But then somebody who comes from the outside, somebody who's not raised in a church, walks in, and then all of a sudden they get the same grace that I get. How is that fair? It doesn't seem fair to me. It seems like it's wrong. It seems like there's something that's missing. He is out of bounds. And here's what happens to so many of us as we understand this, because as it concludes, he says this. Jesus makes this statement as it continues on. He says that Zacchaeus stands before Jesus and he says, I'll give half my wealth to the poor. If I cheated anybody on their taxes, I'll give them back four times as much. And then Jesus makes this comment. He says, salvation has come to this home today, for this man has shown himself to be a true son of Abraham. This continually angers the people, and even for some of us in the room, it angers us. And the reason is because grace is unexpected and unsettling generosity. For some of you in the room, who are sitting here and you say, I don't deserve anything that Jesus would give me. It's unexpected. And to some of us in the room, that we go back and we say, man, I've been pretty good my whole life. I mean, there was that one time in grade school that I remember I made a mistake, but it was so tiny and nobody really understands that. I've really been a good person my whole life. I listen to us at times when we have arguments and difficulties with one another, and we tend to agree with the person that we look at and say, well, I know this person, and they've really never even done anything wrong. They've always been a good person. And it's so unexpected and unsettling for some of us in this process. And so the question that I want to ask, and I want to just conclude with this, is why is it that I struggle with this? Why is it that I struggle with this? I got to be honest with you. There are those times that I see people who find Christ and accept him, and they tell about these incredible life stories that they were so far removed and God got a hold of them and those kind of things. And I sit there and there are those moments that I'm sitting there going, God, look, I've been around. I've tried to stay faithful to you. I've done a couple of bad things, but not some really bad things. So why in the world would you give me this hand? Why is it that I get the exact same thing as this guy right here? Why is it when I look at eternity, he's going to be in the same spot that I am? And even for some of us, we can't imagine eternity with some people who wronged us. And the reason that we can't is because we say, look, I'm better. I figured out a way to be better. And the point is this, they do not deserve the same thing that I get. And Jesus would describe this and a story that he would tell called a parable. And in parables, Jesus usually had two major characters. There's the you character, or you and me character, and then there's the Jesus character, or the God character. And in this story, he tells this idea of what would happen. There's some people gathered around, so Jesus tells the story in Matthew chapter 20. He says, "The kingdom of heaven is like the landowner who went out early one morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay the normal daily wage, and he sent them out into the fields to work. This was pretty common, that in this day, and even in today, in certain parts of the United States, they call these folks day laborers. And what would happen is, these folks would be standing around looking for a job, and you would be able to walk by, and you would try to find and say, hey, who wants a job today? And they'd raise their hands, and they'd say, you, I need you to get this job done today. And so this guy goes, and he hires these individuals, he brings them back to his farm, and he's in the process of trying to help these guys. And so here's what would happen. At 9 o'clock, a few hours later, he would go and he was passing through the marketplace and he saw some people standing around and they're doing nothing. So he hired them, telling them that he'd pay them whatever was right at the end of the day. Then the story continues on and he says this, they went to work in the vineyard at noon. Again, at 3 o'clock, he did the same thing. And then here's what's interesting, because in this day and age, you usually stopped working at about 6 o'clock at night. And here's what happens. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he was in town again and saw more people standing around. So he has this conversation with them. He says this. Next one there, he asked them, why haven't you been working today? They replied, no one hired us. So he said, go out and join the others in my vineyard. Understand, these folks are going to work an hour or less before they're finished. Now, any of us in the room would look at this and say, okay, I get this. I get that there were people that were there all day. There are people that got hired in the middle of the day. There are people that came at the very end of the day. And then there's people that came an hour, just not even worked an entire hour. So what happens in this scenario? And so he continues on. That evening, he told the foreman to call the workers in and pay them, beginning with the last workers first. When those hired at 5 o'clock were paid, each received a full day's wage. Now, if you're like me, and you got hired on pretty early in the day, and you see these guys getting a big fistful of 50s, you're thinking to yourself, woohoo, this day's gonna get good for me. But you know how the story unfolds. Because here's what happens. When those hired first came to get their pay, they assumed they would receive more, but they too were paid a day's wage. And they, when they received their pay, they protested to the owner. Here's what they say. These people worked only an hour, and yet you paid them just as much as you paid us, who worked all day in the scorching heat. We worked every single moment of this day. We've done everything that we could possibly do. We listened to you. And this for you to understand today, for those of you in the room who struggle with this idea and this understanding, is that grace is unfair. It's not fair. That the person sitting beside you may have lived a life that was 20 times worse than yours, and they're going to receive the same thing as you, even though you lived a life that you thought was good and right. And so this understanding of grace and the difficulty that people had is the unfairness of what grace is. The owner of the vineyard would answer to the folks this way. He would say this. One of them, he said, friend, I haven't been unfair. I didn't agree. He says, didn't you agree to work all day for the usual wage? Take your money and go. And then he would add to this. He said, I wanted to pay this last worker the same as you. Is it against the law for me to do what I want with my money? Should you be jealous because I'm kind to others? And this is the struggle for so many of us in the room. It's jealousy. You see, you and I have a tendency to compare and determine what's fair, don't we? You may not, but I'll at least be honest enough and say that I do. That at times when I meet individuals and I look at them and I say, tell me your story, and they begin to tell me their story, I begin to look at it and say, okay, well, on the scale of one to the worst story I've ever heard, where do I fit in this story? Because there's something in me that says, you know, I gave my life to Christ as a young boy. I was born, and a few days after I was born, I was in my first church service, and I've never really missed many church services along the way, and I've been a fairly good person, and I've tried a lot of stuff over the years, and I've figured some things out, and so quite honestly, I mean, I should be way up here, and here's this person that I'm meeting, and they're way down here, and there's something in me that begins to look at it and say, okay, as I put my story together, I'm probably at this percentage right here, and for you and I, we have a tendency to do those kind of things. And even Jesus calls it out and says, it's true, because we all look at it. We all try to figure these things out. But here's the way Jesus sees it. We compare to determine what's fair, but grace doesn't compare. Here's the thing. You can look at your neighbor and say, I'm in better health than my neighbor. I look better than my neighbor. I'm better than my neighbor. I'm younger than my neighbor. I'm richer than my neighbor. I'm the best person that's ever been on my row. Nobody's as good as me. And you could say all of those kinds of things. And you can look and say, okay, if we're going to do some kind of aggregate here on our row, I'm probably going to win. But the point is this. Jesus doesn't look at the aggregate of the people around you. He only looks at you, and he determines that grace is unfair and that grace happens to anyone. And to some of us in the room, man, we love hearing that we get a chance at grace. And to others of us, it's pretty unsettling, isn't it? Because we think all people should be in except this. And you determine your standard. But Jesus doesn't determine his standard. And this is why Jesus would conclude that whole passage by saying these words. So those who are last now, they'll be first then. And those who are first will be last. Grace doesn't compare. And so here's the question for you. Today, regardless of what you have done, regardless of how bad you have screwed things up in your world, regardless of who you've screwed over, and it may be somebody sitting in this room, the truth for you to know is that grace is available for you. That Jesus Christ, this very perfect and holy one, became your sacrifice and my sacrifice. And whether some of us in the room need this much grace or some of us in the room need this much grace, the reality is all of this grace is sufficient enough for you and for me. And I want you to know that today, for some of you, this is the greatest hope you've ever had. Because you know that you've thrown your life away. You know you've made choices and decisions. And you know you don't deserve it. You know that you don't merit it. You know that it is something that you've done in the course of your life. And you've wronged others and you've hurt others. And you've given others so much pain. And you're saying to yourself, if anybody in the room is disqualified, it's me. And I want you to know this is the hope of your new year. That it's available to you. And then to some of us, it's unsettling. It's scary. Because the system that we've put together determines that people who are pedophiles don't deserve grace. And those who are semi-good and only speed once in a while do deserve grace. This is the system that determines that those who are criminals don't deserve grace if they've committed these crimes, and those who've only done this much wrong deserve grace. And for us in the room, it's as unsettling as it was in the day of Jesus. So I want to offer the invitation that Christ offered to every man, woman, and child in this room today for you to say yes to the very grace that Christ came to offer. And for some of us, it's a reconfirmation. You've been a Christian for a long time, and you know that there's some struggles, and you kind of go, man, there's some things that don't seem fair. I get it. because sometimes I go through the same things. But for you to recognize that Christ died for you and that eternity awaits for you, it's a reaffirmation to you on this day that you say yes to Christ again. And for some of you in the room who go back and said, man, I said yes to Christ, but the problem is I live life. I screwed this thing up. I made this mistake. And if we were to have you come up here and tell us the biggest mistakes you made, some of us in the room would be, you still get the privilege of grace today. So my question is, who wants it? Who wants it? And so what we're going to do is I'm going to have us put our heads down, and whether you're an eye closer at prayer time or not, that's fine with you. So put your head down, and I'm going to ask you to repeat after me a very simple phrase, some words, and these words aren't the magical words, but they are simply the words that describe that you're asking for this grace to be a part of your life. And whether you asked God to be a part of your life and you said, Jesus, let this grace come into my life, and you did it at age 6 and you've been believing it and living it ever since, or whether you decide today for the very first time, I'm going to say yes to this Jesus. I'm going to say yes to the guy who takes the most notorious sinner and loves him. I'm going to say yes to the guy who's willing to let me, who comes to the party 5 minutes before it's over, and still give me the opportunity for eternal life. So wherever you're at on this, if you're there and you're ready to say yes to Jesus, or you're ready to confirm your relationship with Jesus, then pray this prayer after me. So let's pray. Jesus, I come to you today. Say that if you would, if that's your confirmation of Christ. Jesus, I come to you today. And I ask you to remind me that you were 100% grace. And this grace is available to me. And I say thank you for giving it to me. And Lord, in this moment, I accept you as my Savior. Knowing this, I don't deserve it. I've not done enough to earn it. And yet, you look at my sin as if it never happened. So Jesus, help me now to extend this same grace to the people in my world. I pray this, Jesus, in your name. And all God's people said, amen.